5 Scientific Negation. This, the last of my series of survivals, and the most vital of them, is very difficult to define. What it is we all appreciate, we still meet it daily. We all know the spirit when we come across it. It is a definite organic thing in the thought of our time, a thing which was triumphant not so long ago and formed indeed, in a generation which has not yet passed away, the main opposition to Catholic truth. It is the spirit which dominated Victorian England and politically, if not socially, captured France in the later 19th century and flooded the French university. It is the spirit which was taken for granted throughout the ruling minds of Bismarck's New Prussian Germany, and, though inherited from the earlier and more cultured German states, was almost identified with the scholarship of the modern Reich. It was taken for granted, outside the Catholic body, as the mark of the intelligent and educated man during the liberal period of the Italian Resurrection. Those who refused to accept that spirit were hardly treated seriously. Catholicism, its sole rival, was in its judgment stricken to death. The faith was necessarily doomed, because positive scientific knowledge disproved it. Catholics were not regarded as competent to discuss philosophy, nor as intellectual equals. The individuals among us who by accident became prominent were thought, at the best, rhetoricians and poets deliberately indulging their emotions at the expense of their reason, at the worst either insincere men taking up an attitude, or mere fools. I have said that it is exceedingly difficult to find a name for this spirit. The popular name is, without a doubt, scientific. All that is connoted to the general mind by way of praise or blame in the words science and scientist attaches to this attitude of mind. But if one uses that word scientific unmodified, the purist will at once object that it is unjustified, for the word science simply means that which is so firmly established by proof from observation or deduction that the opposite cannot be entertained. For instance, science teaches us that acorns grow into oaks, that the hyperbola is a section of the right cone, that the earth is round, that water treated in certain fashion turns into two other very different substances with individual qualities very different from those of water, which substances we call oxygen and hydrogen. It is clear that science, used in this sense, cannot be the opponent of any scheme of transcendental doctrine. It can have no relation to a theology and therefore cannot be the enemy of that theology. The one word relates to research for the establishment of certain truths by experience in the physical world, the other to a philosophy. You might find out all there was to find about the reactions of matter without its helping you in the least to decide whether the universe be created or self-existent from all eternity. You might learn all there was to be learned of contemporary evidence on a man's saint life in the remote past without being any nearer to a decision as to whether that man's saint claim to be God incarnate were an illusion or a statement of reality. Nevertheless, it was round this neutral word, scientific, that those connotations arose which gave it its effect in the controversies of the immediate past. There was such a thing as the scientific spirit of which men boasted, or to which men pointed with scorn. There was such a thing as a school of thought connected with research into physics and, by extension, into documents and monuments, which was not only admittedly opposed to the spirit of the Catholic Church, but which produced in every department of social activity, from letters to architecture, and from architecture to legislation, fruits inimical to, and destructive of, Christian civilization. It is that spirit of which I speak. In an attempt to approach accuracy, I have modified the single word by another, and I give this spirit the title of scientific negation. A title, however accurate, is not an exposition. When we tell a foreigner that there is among us an institution called the House of Lords, we give him no general idea of it. To do that, we must describe its functions, recruitment and character. Let us so proceed with the matter in hand. Scientific negation. Scientific negation was a system based upon a newly extended and a newly exact observation and coordination of evidence, primarily in the field of physics and thence in the field of documents, of relics left from man's ancient handiwork, of social customs and so on. So far its action was strictly scientific in the precise sense of that word. Facts were established beyond the possibility of doubt, and newly established. The method earned prestige by its rapid extension of human knowledge. Its followers were rightly respected as men who could teach us a very great deal more than had hitherto been known, and who had widely broadened the basis of human experience. For instance, Manifold observations proved the presence of innumerable fossil organisms in the rocks of the Earth. The coordination of these showed that, in an overwhelming number of them, the fossils came in a certain order of depth, such and such in lower strata, such and such in higher. It further showed that, of these fossil organisms, some were identical with animals and vegetables which exist on Earth today, while others were of a sort which, so far as we can discover, no longer so exist. They are, apparently, extinct. If a man were so foolish as to challenge this discovery, the proofs could be submitted, they were patent to all, and he was hopelessly discomfited. The increasing army of observers prided themselves on their integrity, the minuteness of their investigations and the accuracy of them. These three qualities are the essence of scientific method and they have been well maintained. Hence arose a capital characteristic of the modern scientist which I will call instructed confidence. He was quite sure of himself and his conclusions. They reposed on no mood or whim of his own. They were not debatable. They were established forever by every canon of the human reason. Opposition to them was invariably defeated without hope of recovery, and his continued experience of such success bred a habit of certainty upon matters requiring his expert knowledge. He was absolutely secure. His opponents were necessarily wrong. So far, I say, the action of the modern scientist had been strictly scientific. But when we proceed to examine his action in more detail, we shall see by what avenues crept in the errors which were to shake his prestige. We note first that all his work was based upon measurement. Nothing was known to him save by measurement, and what cannot be precisely measured was outside his province. Next, we note that in this study there was necessarily present at every moment, in all its details and conclusions, as the very note of its activity, an unchanging sequence of cause and effect. Dependence upon such a sequence was not new, it was as old as human culture. A man sowed because innumerable experiences in the past had shown that from seed as a cause followed harvest. What was new was the restricting of the study to this sequence of material cause and effect, the exclusion of all beyond them. The modern scientific method did not discover the regular connection of physical cause with physical effect any more than it discovered the art of breathing. What it not discovered but inaugurated was a habit of dealing with this alone, to the exclusion of less rigid things. Now this exclusion of all not measurable and of all not physical was a first impediment to the discovery of reality, a first step out of the path of right reason, a deviation which was bound, at last, to render the wanderer ridiculous. For instance, I am presented the poetic line, "And what is more, you'll be a cad, my boy." I affirm this line on my general judgment to be written not earlier than 1870, and probably after 1900, and in the manner of Mr. Kipling. It is affirmed against me that the line is of the late 17th century, from the pen of Dryden. I say that is impossible. I do not base my certitude on anything which can be tested by a metric test. It is a spiritual or moral conclusion, reposing on my sense and experience of language, style and the mental attitude of the two ages. The scientific method is called in to arbitrate. It proceeds to note and measure all the physical circumstance. The paper on which the fragment is written is by every test identical with that of certain Dryden MSS. The handwriting is indistinguishable from that of Dryden, and even under the microscope certain characteristics of his lettering are revealed. The ink, on analysis, proves to be the same sort as that with which he wrote, and its color proves its age. The scientific method concludes with certitude that the line is Dryden's ain't. But I am right and the scientific method is wrong. Where it went wrong I may not discover, though probably with research I shall do so, but that it is wrong the common sense of mankind will agree. The scientist has made a fool of himself. He may have been deceived by forgery or a hoax. Old paper may have been used in the age of the ink imitated in the handwriting as well. Perhaps individual words and letters in Dryden's ain't handwriting have been photographed and retraced in that ink. I don't know. But anyhow, the line is certainly not Dryden's ain't, and as certainly it is of the late 19th or early 20th centuries. The instance is grotesque, and on that account did I choose it, as an extreme example. But it is not much more absurd than some of the stuff we have had from the higher critics. So much for the first cause of error. There is another and graver one. The scientific method proceeds from postulate to hypothesis, thence to the confirmation of hypothesis by further experiment and the search for converging evidence supporting it. This being discovered, the hypothesis ceases to be called an hypothesis and is called a scientifically proved fact, a scientific truth. For instance, the postulate is made that water, in all ages, has had the same effect on sand as it has today. I make the hypothesis that a desert ravine was once a riverbed. My hypothesis is confirmed by the presence of sand stratified as it would be if laid down today by water, and further research discovers fossils of freshwater fish. My hypothesis is now called a scientific truth, not established directly by the certain evidence of the senses. No one has seen the gully full of water but by inference. Now this process, which is of the essence of the scientific method, is valuable and has led to innumerable useful discoveries. It has not, for the establishment of truth, the same degree of value that direct evidence has. Yet it is given that false value. It may go wrong on either limb. The postulate may be incorrect or the confirmation of the hypothesis insufficient, and both are always at the mercy of a new observation. For instance, a scientist postulates that the more degraded a savage tribe, the more nearly does it resemble our remote ancestors. He finds fossil human relics resembling in their measurements those of a degraded modern type of savage. He forms the hypothesis that these fossils belong to a society which, like his modern savage, makes no baked pottery and has no knowledge of smelting. The hypothesis is confirmed by the absence of shards in metal in connection with the fossil bones. He affirms it as scientifically established fact that this primitive type was a very early one and had no metals. But it is not proven fact. It is still hypothesis and at the mercy of a new discovery. It is found that the ancestors of these modern savages, not so long ago, made pottery and smelted metals, and that so far from being primitive, they have fallen from a higher level of culture. His scientific fact has gone to join a thousand others, as confidently asserted and as contemptuously dismissed by reality, the truthless enemy of scientific pride. That is a simple example and obviously leads to no contradiction of religious truths. But wait a moment. We observe already the tendency to accept hypothesis for fact, and the capital point that measurement occupies all the activities of the man and measurement is a mechanical operation. We note that these are coupled with a long-established habit of instructed certitude. Lastly, our knowledge of men tells us that they establish among themselves, in any occupation, a corporate tradition or school in the tenets of which the older members of the craft are firmly fixed, not to say rusted, and into which recruits subscribe unconsciously as they are absorbed into the main body. Put all this together and what would you expect, men being what they are? You would expect that with time a body would grow up of those engaged in such tasks, which body would, without direct incorporation, be bound together by common achievements, a common tradition and a common spirit. You would expect that devotion to mere measurement would tend to create a contempt for those forms of experience to which measurement cannot apply. You would expect that a greater and greater mass of hypothesis would be dogmatically advanced as fact, that when one hypothesis posing as fact broke down, instead of admitting error, another hypothesis would be framed to hide the gap, until at last a whole structure of imaginary's hypotheses built up on other hypotheses ad infinitum would raise its flimsy fog to the concealment of reality. You would expect that great achievements in the practical application of discovery would lead to such men's ain't claiming a right to advise in matters outside their province and, when possible, to dictate and enforce their conclusions by law. You would expect such a spirit to come in conflict with the common sense of mankind and especially with the transcendental affirmations of religion which no mechanical system can comprehend. Finally, you would expect that, in such a conflict, common sense and religion combined would discover the weakness of their opponent's saint position and would wreck it. And that is exactly what has happened. The scientists came, the greater part of them, to form an unacknowledged international body. Its members for the most part took the non-measurable subjects of knowledge to be negligible. Hypothesis disguised as proved fact rioted everywhere, from guesses at the hidden antiquities of the earth to guesses at impossible authorship of the classics. On the breakdown of a false hypothesis, error was not admitted but new hypotheses invented to hide the failure. Too many affirmations were exploded, too many prophecies failed, and at last the common sense of mankind rebelled. Still more important in the production of scientific negation was the formation of mental habits. A study which dealt only with innumerable examples of apparently invariable sequence and material cause and effect, and which neglected all considerations exterior to that sequence, produced, in minds not strong enough to distinguish between habitual ideas and logic few minds today are so strong, an irrational conception that such sequence was universal, necessary and unfailing, that exceptions to it could not exist. The miraculous, the exceptional, was impossible. Posterity will be amused or amazed, I think, to remark so grotesque an aberration of the mind, as we are amused and amazed today by the astronomical errors of Ptolemists or by the credulity of 10th century hagiographers. But so it was. The scientist proceeded to scientific negation through this quite irrational mental habit. Every time a human body has been weighed by me and my colleagues, it has been found heavier than air. Therefore levitation is impossible. The high water mark of this confused thinking was reached in the late 70th and early 80th. I quote from a book typical of those days. It is that of Baird Saint Lectures, published in 83. Every day adds to the overwhelming accumulation of evidence that he, God though he might, never does interfere with the operation of natural sequence called laws. Note the word evidence. Was ever such nonsense? There is evidence of natural sequence. Of course, identical pieces of evidence by millions and trillions have guided mankind from the beginning and still do. We base all our lives on such evidence. But what rational connection is there between the general sequence and the impossibility of exception? Yet the writer of 1883 honestly believed he was thinking when he was only feeling, reasoning, when he was but suffering in emotion. That process which, as we have just seen, might have been expected to take place is exactly what has happened. There are numerous exceptions, but the main body of modern scientists has gone down that road, and therefore the quasi-philosophic position in which they were so assured is now ruined, for it warred with reason. It is no good protesting that the true scientist is nothing of all this, that he does no more than patiently observe, never affirms a thing to be proved until it is, humbly rejects any claim to talk on things that are beyond him. Obviously the ideal scientist would behave so. But the human scientist, belonging as he does to a fallen race, didn't behave so. He denied wholesale. His scientific negation was, until lately, the mark of all our time. For there followed from a confirmed habit of unreasonably postulating the necessary and universal sequence of material cause and effect the gravest result, the very principle of negation in scientific negation. It was as follows. Since exception to natural sequence by the action of will was, muddle-headedly, thought or rather felt to be impossible, the scientist denied wholesale all that was external to it. He denied, of course, all the supernatural in bulk. The birth of our Lord from a virgin, the miracles, the incarnation, the Eucharist, revelation, immortality, all the creed. But he also denied spiritual perceptions. He denied the whole basis of the faith. Let no one plead that he did so as an individual and did not engage a body of thought. The examples were innumerable. They covered Europe, and even today the valiant survivals carry on. Sir Arthur Keith, speaking not out of his private opinions but as a scientist and from what he seems most strangely to have taken at this time of day exclamation for scientific evidence, recently proved to us, himself a survival, that there was no survival of the human soul after death. I have put the scientific negation here on the extreme edge of the survivals, marking it as a thing which, though it has already passed its zenith, is still of such power among us that it might almost seem to form today, as it certainly did 40 or 50 years ago, the main contemporary force in opposition to Catholic truth. The reason I include it thus among the survivals at all is that it is weakening, and by that mark may be distinguished from another, later force, its baser byproduct with which I shall deal in a few pages. That product of scientific negation is now our chief main opponent, and I shall describe as such under the title of the modern mind. Scientific negation is defeated. It knows that it is defeated, and it is beginning to retreat. Let us sum up the causes of its failure, the weaknesses which have turned it into a survival. It has failed partly through its own self-contradictions, partly through its extravagances, more because the imperfection of its method has been exposed, and that exposure was largely provoked by its arrogance. Its self-contradiction, It positively affirmed on one day irrefutable dogmas such as the indestructible and indivisible atom, which it had to abandon the next. It made matters worse by not frankly admitting error and never does but by pretending that its instruction had expanded. Its extravagances, as in its talk of alcohol of which no mortal ever made a beverage nor will, of eugenics and sterilization of the unfit which are half murderous and half inept, of the coming changes in man, which didn't happen, of its right to control our lives and perform on us every inhuman experiment. But the main work has been done by its exposure on the part of those whom it despised. They began to insist that a man who said as one of their principal spokesmen did "we cannot really know a thing unless we can measure it" was below the normal level in reasoning power. They maintained with success that the certain must be preferred to the grossly uncertain, our moral sense for example to a succession of vague and quite unfounded guesses as to its prehistoric origin, and our experience of real things beef, mutton, earth, sky, sea, love, bread, wine, poetry to imaginaries the ether, for instance, which were talked of as familiarly as the air we breathe but which no man ever has known or can know. We know the Gospels, we know their profound effect, but as for Q, what is that ridiculous figment compared with them? Thus has it failed. For the special quality of scientific negation in all its various branches in physical theory, or rather in false metaphysics ill-reasoned from physical research in what is called the higher criticism, in what is called comparative religion and all the rest of it, was, as I have said, instructed confidence. When that confidence came to be shaken, both in its own heart and in the judgment of others, the essential principle of the thing collapsed. Ferrer's ain't judgment stands. The men of the 19th century thought they knew all. They knew nothing. Its passing is not without the power to move us. Its exponents of that older generation, such as the great Huxley in one field, Renan in another, were men of remarkable stature. They not only had high powers of expression, but a very deep knowledge of their subjects. So armed, they had come to the fixed conclusion that the universe was thus and thus, incompatible with the Catholic doctrine. Today the survivals of their kind, men often highly instructed, and also highly gifted in expression, are not, at heart, confident. They feel what their forerunners never felt, the weight of our fire. We have in England many such survivors of that older type. They are in especial strength here, because in the Protestant culture the opposition to these false pretensions was ill-founded. They know little of the Catholic reply, yet even so they show all the symptoms of decline. They are as dogmatic as ever their elders were, but every one of them carries the scars of wounds received in controversy, such as their elders never knew. They affirm with the same vigor as was common in a time happier for their school, but it is a vigor used on the defensive. The one will confidently assert that the fourth gospel has been proved to be no work of an eyewitness, the other will as confidently reaffirm the old dogma that there is no design in animated nature, that all teleological conceptions are false and that no creator is needed. But in each case one feels that the attitude is no longer the attitude of the 1870 saint. It is no longer the old forward triumphant attack brushing aside a resistance which it could afford to despise. It is the attitude of a man on his guard, expecting to meet heavier and heavier counter blows. It is a defensive that wobbles and sometimes screams. It often has to shield itself by refusing to consider evidence, or by insufficient quotation, or even by silence. Of old, the man who in the Protestant culture got rid of a creative God by making development mechanical, expected to find against him at the worst some negative argument which further research would disprove. He was rightly contemptuous of such futile defense. If he were told that his evidence was fragmentary, and therefore inconclusive, he could confidently await a mass of new knowledge, the extension of which proceeded prodigiously year by year. Commonly, he was met either by obscurantism, that is, a refusal to look at the evidence, or by appeals to mere emotion such as "can we believe that the marvelous structure of the human eye," etc., etc., or by thoroughly bad logic, such as the confusion between the facts of evolution in general and a particular false theory upon its cause, as when a man said, "I do not believe in natural selection, because it would have me descended from an ape," or by begging the question, as by an appeal to the authority of Scripture which the scientist did not admit. Today it is quite another pair of shoes. The man who gallantly proclaims the old-fashioned dogma of mechanical natural selection as disproving design and a creator, is dreadfully aware of what he has to meet, and he meets it, to his discomfiture. It is he now, and not his opponent, who has to fall back upon doubtful forms of argument, to quibbling or to mere thumping of the table. It is he who is driven to phrases like "all authorities are agreed" or "no biologist with a reputation to lose will deny," and so on. Thus, in a recent controversy, one of our most distinguished opponents, arguing against a creator, quoted as an example of the working of natural selection the destruction of light moths upon a dark background, and of dark moths upon a light background. Whether this were unintelligence or quibbling is immaterial, it was manifest nonsense. The point is not whether animals get killed under circumstances hostile to them, of course they do, but whether dead and blind environment will mechanically and blindly produce a new kind of animal and endow it with new qualities. It is not a question of whether prolonged frost will kill bees, but of how a bee comes to make his invariable angle for the cell with the wax he fashions. The old textual attack has gone down the same road. When a man quietly took it for granted in my youth that the fourth gospel was far too late to be cited as testimony, he had with him nearly all that counted in Europe. The counterattack had not developed. Today he has to read from his own champion the final conclusion that it may have fallen within the lifetime of the apostle and undoubtedly contains much Johannine material. It does indeed. It is so all along the line. And this strongest of the survivals is but a survival now. Would that it had left no progeny. Dash.